Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. A lot of people have come to believe that the internet has made their lives better. They're better connected, plugged in, and even able to work from home. But our guest today looks at it far differently. He says the internet was built as a non-commercial zone, a genuine public sphere, which would lead to far greater public awareness, stronger communities, and greater political participation. Instead, in his words, it's become commercialized, copyrighted, patented, privatized, data inspected, and monopolized. Cases in point, just look at Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon, which seem to grow more entrenched by the day, and they seem to understand that almost everything about what makes you and me tick all the time. Later on this hour, daily life in Pakistan, but first up, is the internet what it was cracked up to be? Our guest today is Robert McChesney. He's author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. He's a professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And Robert, so good to have you. Good morning.
My pleasure to be here, Steve.
Well, at the core of this book, it seems to me, is this notion that, you know, that capitalism, democracy, and the internet aren't exactly 100% compatible with one another, particularly capitalism, which has seen better days considering, you know, the current economic state. Am I getting that right?
You nailed it, actually. We could have a short interview, but it'd probably
We're done.
Be wise for
us. Thanks a lot, Bob. Yeah.
Yeah. But probably help to elaborate on what we mean, though, when we say that. But you're right. I mean, I think I'm a political economist of media. I've been studying the internet for 20 years, but I've also been studying the relationship of our economy and our governance system, capitalism, democracy. And that relationship has historically been a tense one. It's been one that has had problems because capitalism is a system that's predicated on some people doing really well, and a lot of people not doing especially well. Democracy is a system predicated upon political equality. That's always been a tension throughout our history. You have ebbs and flows. And the promise of the internet, when it came along in the late 80s and early 90s, the promise of the internet was that it was going to throw things in the side of democracy. It was going to give people without a lot of property, without a lot of privilege, the capacity to get information and participate that would have been unthinkable before, and really be a force to sort of blow the stick over towards the democracy side of the field and enhance the quality of the lives of the great bulk of the people.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that was what really excited so many people 20 years ago.
And so was that, as you look back on it now, was that an unrealistic expectation?
No, not at all. I think that something that's been lost, I think, except for people, you know, who go back that far and were paying close attention, is that the vision of the internet that came out of the 1970s, 80s, and into the 90s was very different than what it was by the end of the 1990s. I mean, in the early 1990s, Mark Andreessen, who started Netscape and was one of the pioneers of commercializing the internet, said the problem he faced as a young entrepreneur and computer scientist was that there was a militantly anti-commercial and egalitarian ethos on the internet as late as 1991 or two. Hmm. That, you know, the idea of the people who created the internet was that it would be strictly non-commercial, it would be strictly non-profit, it would be a place everyone would come as equals and participate as citizens. The theory was that in American society, there were lots of places to buy and sell stuff. There was no shortage of markets or commercialism or advertising. It wasn't like that was a need. We had to have more places for that.
So what happened? Well,
I think, you know, I write about this in the book. It's really an interesting process, how you went from that sort of understanding of what the internet should be and what it was in, say, 1991 or two, to by the end of the 1990s, it was like whoever makes the most money wins, whoever dies with the most toys wins. It just went 180 degrees in the other direction. And, you know, a couple of things happen. There are three or four things. First of all, part of the charm and attraction of the internet, it seems infinite. So it seemed like, you know, we can do our nonprofit thing, but then Rupert Murdoch and Google and advertisers can do their thing. And there's room for everyone online. Mm-hmm. So we don't really need to worry about what the commercial guys are up to. That was one of the issues. The second issue was that in the early 1990s, we had the worst economic recession we had probably had, at least since the 70s and possibly since the Second World War. Nothing like what we've had in the last few years, but still it was painful. It got Bill Clinton elected president in 1992 on the slogan, "It's the economy, stupid."
Yeah, right.
And we had a very strong recovery. in the middle to late 1990s, and much of that recovery was attributed to sort of the commercialization of the internet. So it was really hard to make the case that you shouldn't commercialize the internet when people are just coming out of a bad recession. And this looks like this is the future of the new economy that's going to take us to a higher standard of living for the next generation or two. So I think you put those two things together, and, you know, you top it off with there were a series of policy decisions that created the internet to keep it going that are being made today about what sort of internet we're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And these decisions were made basically behind closed doors with almost no public participation. These are government policy decisions. And the system is pretty, you know, as I chronicle in the book and much of my research has been about, when it comes to communication policy making in the United States, these decisions are made almost exclusively by powerful interests with no public input. So powerful interests that saw a way to make money are basically writing the rules of the game. They wrote rules that made it possible for them to make a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, you know, you look back on it now, Bob, it seems, you know, armchair quarterback, it's always 20/20 vision here, but it just seems so inevitable that it would have, you know, taken on this major commercial component at least at some point.
It does and it doesn't. I mean, the way history works is when something happens and you look back at it, it oftentimes seems inevitable because actually it exists and it prospers. And clearly we're in a situation, as I chronicle in the book, where internet companies dominate our economy. So it does seem inevitable. How could you possibly stop this tidal wave of history? But at the same time, you know, you can also look back and do a counterfactual and say, you know, it could have gone in a different direction. So, you know, it didn't have to go this way. And if it had events been somewhat different, had the internet come along at a certain different period in history, it might not have gone this way. I'll give you a good example historically so it makes sense of this. You know, the United States has commercial radio and television primarily, except for a handful of stations like this. But the public and non-commercial systems always been very marginal in the United States compared to other countries.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
First book was on this. I had a show on our NPR station. I'm a big fan of public broadcasting, but it's just, you know, on the dial, it's a much smaller portion of radio and television than it is in most other democratic nations. But in other nations, you know, Americans assume this had to be the only way it could possibly be. But in other commercial capitalist nations, they went through the same political process we did to create broadcasting, and almost all of them opted for a system that was primarily non-commercial and non-profit. And so, you know, it clearly wasn't inevitable. There was nothing in the DNA that required that. It was a political decision.
So what sort of commercial influences at the end of the day are you most concerned about, you know, in relation to the internet? I mean, is it selling personal social media information to marketers? Is it the privacy thing? What is it exactly?
Well, I think you've hit on the one that has gotten everyone's attention. One of the things I'm proud about in the book Digital Disconnect, when I was doing the research for it, the book, I finished it in the end of 2012, and it came out early in 2013, just before the whole Edward Snowden NSA brouhaha emerged. And now I think it's great for me because everyone sort of understands now, it's not controversial to say that everything you do online is being followed. You have no privacy. Mm-hmm. That's over. That's dead. And it's not – we emphasize the NSA and the government, which is clearly one of the forces. But what's more frightening to me is that it's the commercial interests really have everything about us. They know everywhere we're going. We're being tracked everywhere. And then to top it off, the commercial interests are working very closely with the government. And that's not a very positive relationship for a free society.
Just how bad, in your view, has it gotten, Bob?
I think it can't get worse. I mean, I think everyone should assume that everything you do online is, if someone wants to know it, they can find it.
Yeah, it's just, and do you think most people understand that, or is that realization still dawning on a bunch of folks out there?
Well, I think they increasingly understand it, but I don't think people know what you do with it because you're so dependent now upon your smartphone and your tablet and your social media and using the internet basically to survive. Our society is built around, you know, you really can't survive unless you're online. It'd be like trying to have an automobile and live in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not possible. So you just say, oh, that's the price I pay. And you hope – you say, well, I'm not a terrorist or a criminal, so it really won't affect me that much. And you don't really – you know, you just – it's not worth bothering with it because there's nothing you can do about it, you feel like. But It does have terrible implications for the quality of our lives, for the nature of our lives. There's a great novel by Dave Eggers called The Circle, which I just read. and it really goes into sort of how this Circle is sort of a company like Google that someone works at. Mm-hmm. And it goes into, like, you know, the whole psychology that goes on in this sort of immersed world where there is no privacy and everything is known about everyone. And it paints, I think, a picture of not an especially happy society. I mean, mm-hmm. it's one that we should be troubled by.
Robert McChesney is our guest. He's the author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. I should point out he'll be speaking at 10 o'clock in the morning, April 6th, that's Sunday, at a forum at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. We'll get an information about that on our website, kcur.org. You know, it's interesting to me. We had New Yorker writer and author George Packer on the show yesterday, and he seems to think that, you know, despite the rising tide of inequality in our economic system, you know, the rich versus the poor, he says we have more freedoms than ever. And there's this notion of our privacy being invaded more than ever. At the same time, we have more freedom than we've ever had before. What do you say to all that, Bob?
Well, I wish I'd heard the interview because I have a lot of respect for Mr. Packer.
Yeah, very impressive guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So I can't really respond unless I know the context and what he means by freedom, because, you know, I think when I look at an issue like freedom, there's the freedom to, like, have a nose ring or to, you know, dye your hair a certain color. I think we've got that freedom. I don't think Americans have to worry about losing the freedom to dress however you want, appear however you want. I think, though, that those freedoms, to be blunt, in my view, are largely trivial. It's nice. I'm glad I can have a nose ring if I want one. No one can tell me I can't.
Right.
I measure freedom, though, the standard I'd use, and it would be that, you know, can we participate effectively in the governance of our society? Are we free? Do we have the right to do that, to weigh in, to say what we want, and be effective? You know, the freedom is linked to the power that comes with self-government. And without that power of self-government, freedom gravitates quickly to being a nose ring and dyeing your hair and having a mohawk. Mm-hmm. And I think that type of freedom, be effective participants as citizens, understood that way, I think we're in real trouble. And I think one of the promises of the internet was it was going to enlarge that freedom. It was going to give people the resources and tools and power to participate in a way they hadn't been able to do before. It was going to really democratize our society. Mm-hmm. And I think at that level, I think we're going very much in the wrong direction. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I should add that the talk I'm doing at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Sunday is about my other book, Dollarocracy, which is all about money and politics and journalism, and really chronicles how our governing system and our election system is increasingly removed from very much public control whatsoever.
Well, it's just interesting, and on that point, the U.S. Supreme Court ruling today that aggregate spending limits are out the window now. It's one more sort of chink in the armor of the ability of this country to regulate campaign spending to any degree, it seems to me. The entire system, at least Justice Stephen Breyer wrote this in his dissenting opinion today, seems to be sort of on very, very shaky legs right now.
Well, I'm glad we're switching gears because this is a subject near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, here we go.
Dollarocracy with John Nichols on this exact subject. It came out at the same time as Digital Disconnect. And, you know, it's, I think that while we're on the subject, listeners should understand that it was before the 1970s, the Supreme Court did not weigh in on how elections should be run or anything like that. That wasn't considered the Supreme Court's business. It was done by governing bodies, states, Congress, legislatures. And the Supreme Court sort of pushed itself into this matter all exclusively with the interest of pursuing the rights of wealthy individuals and companies to spend as much money as they want. That's been the driving force in all their work. And, you know, it hasn't been a slam dunk since the 70s. Chief Justice William Rehnquist, the great conservative chief justice from the 70s until the last decade, opposed letting all these sort of unlimited money spending and elections. He understood that that would really destroy having what would be seen as free and fair elections. But now, since he's gone, there's a majority in the court that genuinely thinks that having the ability to spend money is the same thing as the ability to speak freedom. So if someone like Shelley Adelson is worth $38 billion, he should be entitled to spend whatever he wants. That's a free society, even though before this moment, the idea that Shelley Adelson would be able to would spend several hundred million dollars unknown, unaccountable money on politics in campaigns was considered anti-democratic. I mean, it's considered obscene, frankly.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Again, Robert McChesney is our guest. His book, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. And we're talking about the internet, you know, being commercialized, out of control, copyrighted, patented, privatized. I'm wondering what your views are about this. Our listeners, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here, our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org, or you can tweet us at kcur up to date. And Mary's calling from Kansas City, Missouri, on some of the same points we're talking about here, Bob, about the intersection of money and politics and the internet. Mary, good morning.
Good morning. Since I got, spoke to your assistant, you've addressed some of the things that I wanted to bring up. With this McCutcheon decision that came down just this morning,
yes,
it is going to raise from like $123,000 an election cycle to $3.6 million that an individual can directly donate to candidates and parties. And, I assume that this is something that Professor McChesney will go into on Sunday morning in his presentation
right
at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. But could you say something about that now, just in terms of the vast quantity of money we're looking at?
Yeah, I'd be glad to, Mary. Thank you for the question. To put this into context, we spent almost $11 billion on all our campaigns in the 2012 election cycle. That was double what was spent in 2008. Hmm. And before 2008, it had gone up 40% every 4 years, basically back to the 70s. So it doubled in the last 4 years. As expected right now, we think it'll double again. We'll be over $20 billion in 2016.
Hmm.
No other democratic nation spends money like this. Germany, we outspend Germany in our national elections 34-1. We vastly outspend them now. We outspend Britain 50-1. We outspend Norway 12-1. Norway's the closest to us. I don't know. And that's because it's such a small population done on a per capita basis. So, and most of this money goes for TV political advertising, making commercial broadcasters very rich. And most of the ads are negative and most of them are offensive, inane, and asinine. We all know this. It's a great problem. Now, the issue with the McCutcheon decision will contribute to the problem, but I have to say that as bad as the decision is, and it's not surprising, and as indefensible, I believe, as it is, the toothpaste is already out of the tube on this issue. The mm-hmm. Citizens United decision mm-hmm. basically made it possible for individuals to give as much money as they want.
Anonymously, yeah.
And effectively, they didn't say it could be anonymous, but effectively it is,
yes,
because there's
right.
a myriad of Cayman Island money laundering techniques that are used that make it impossible to regulate. And so you can give as much money as you want. You just can't give it directly to the candidate. You have to give it to an ostensibly independent group, which is actually just a front group for the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
So it just means that now they can give more money directly to candidates instead of to their front groups if they want to juggle their books a little bit. But it won't mean that they can spend more than they would have really before.
Yeah. I want to go back to our conversation about the internet here a little bit, Bob. And how would you change it if you could wave your magic wand today and change it? What would you do with it?
Well, I think there are three immediate crises to deal with. And I'll start with probably the one we haven't talked about yet, which is nearest and dearest to my heart. Journalism is dead in the mm-hmm. United States, commercial journalism. It's dying. I mean, my brother lives in Kansas City, and I visit him there and pick up the daily newspaper. And you can
be careful now. I still work for that place and I still enjoy it, Bob.
Well, my point is, and it's like everywhere else in the country, not just Kansas City. By the time I get from the front door to the breakfast room table, I've read all the news articles,
mm-hmm.
The original ones based in Kansas City, because there's hardly any working reporters left in this country compared to, say, 20 or 25 years ago on a per capita basis. We're down to maybe a third or 40%. And that's because the commercial model of journalism is now dead. And the reason for that is that journalism in America for the last 120 years has been supported overwhelmingly by advertising dollars.
Mm-hmm.
As we move to an online world, advertisers no longer buy ads on website and hope they get people they want to reach to come to the website. Instead, advertisers go to one of the great networks like Google or AOL or Yahoo or Microsoft, and they say, I want to buy 2 million women 18 to 24 who might be in the market for running shoes in the next month. And they'll find those 2 million women wherever they are online. They don't have to go to a content-producing website, a news website, and buy an ad there and have some of the money pay for the news. And as a result, the internet is basically, it's over for commercial journalism. So I think we've got to come up with policies to create independent, uncensored, competitive, nonprofit newsrooms that'll be digital. So we have people covering politics, covering elections, covering the relationships of politicians with powerful interests. All this stuff is basically not being covered now. We're in the dark increasingly in this country on issue after issue.
I mean, isn't the answer on that front just this notion of foundations, you know, philanthropic or foundations sort of pitching in and beginning to sort of sponsor news gathering in this country?
Well, that's, you know, I would say that's helpful, but that might get us about to the 1 foot line, and we've got to go 100 yards. I mean, the evidence is in on this. There's just not enough money for foundations to do that. They've got a lot of other stuff on their plate. They're not, it's just not going to work that way. And also, you know, foundations have agendas too. You know, they've got, you know, it's not like they are knights in shining armor. They've got their own agendas. I think it's a public policy issue, and I've written about this a lot. The founders of this country saw creating an independent free press, a fourth estate, as important as setting up the other three branches of government. They instituted massive policies, subsidies through the post office and printing contracts to guarantee there'd be a rich, vibrant press system in this country. They had no illusion the market could do it, because this is before advertising came along. You know, they saw it as a public policy problem. We've got to view it the same way. And in my work, I've discussed how we could do it, how there are ways we could have publicly funded news media without the government controlling the content, which I think is the great issue you want to address.
Interesting.
So that's one
issue,
and I don't think that one's going away. Secondly, and I think this is an issue near and dear to everyone in America, we have access to the internet has been shifted through corrupt policymaking from being sort of an open competitive system where you had countless people trying to give you internet access over the same wires, the telephone wires in the 1990s, to where basically we have a cartel now that controls access to broadband internet or to cell phones. Really, three companies, Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon, have divvied up the world, the United States. And if you want to get internet access, they set the terms. Now, there are a few other companies like Sprint and T-Mobile or whatever it's called, and Charter Communication on the margins. But they basically take their cues from the big three that have divvied up the market. And as a result, Americans pay far more for cell phones and broadband access than people do anywhere else in the world for much crappier service. I mean, it's a really horrible service. And Americans are not aware of this until they go to another country or until they talk to someone from another country who comes to America and says, why are you paying so much for this crummy service?
Wow.
What a lousy deal. Now, you're in Kansas City, you've got Google Plus doing that thing to show just how you could have much better service, because they were so frustrated with how bad internet access is. They said, we're going to just fire a shot over the bow of these companies, say, this is what the rest of the world gets. Why can't we have this in America? It would be great for everyone. But they have no incentive. They own the government. They own the politicians. They have a cartel set up, so they have no incentive to upgrade their network. So they just get charged through the teeth and just make tons of money. I think we should get rid of these guys. They really serve no function. Let's just make it a public right. Make it like the post office. Everyone gets access to the internet for free. It's a municipal or national post office where they take the profit out of it and just have a high-grade network that makes it easy to get to, easy to use, free, and stop putting this is a huge source of profits for people who don't deserve the profits.
Right. You know, you mentioned, you know, the government sort of coming to the aid of newspapers or journalism writ large, talking about free access for the internet or some sort of way to get more people engaged with the internet. You can't imagine those kinds of policies passing this Congress anytime soon.
No, but, you know, I'm a big believer that you have to say, here's the problem, here's the solution, and then you educate people. You don't just say, well, here's the problem, the solution can't get passed in this Congress, so I'm going to taper it back and come up with a solution that could get passed, which won't do anything to address the problem. Mm-hmm. If it's a serious problem, like the lack of journalism, like getting fleeced by our ISPs, it deserves a serious solution. And I think here we can take a lesson from the page of the organizers who worked on gay marriage. And marriage equality. Mm-hmm. I remember 10 years ago when people would mention this, and all my friends would say, oh, we can't talk about that. It'll cost our good guy candidates votes in the election if they get caught on that. Can't do that. We have to just bring it back to what is acceptable right now. And the organizers, to their credit, said, you know what? this is right. What we're saying is a fundamental issue where we're right and wrong. What we need to simply do is educate people. And once they see it as a civil rights issue, as a human rights issue, they'll come around. We believe people will get understand. And they stuck to their guns, and darn it, they won. And I think sometimes when you're right, you just, and you know that there's no other solution, you've got to stick to your guns and say, we'll educate you. Let's talk about it. But we're not going to back down just for the momentary pleasure of maybe having someone say, okay, I like you more now, even though we're not going to do anything.
Robert McChesney is our guest. He's the author of Digital Disconnect. He speaks at 10 o'clock in the morning this Sunday at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City. More information about that on our website. Let's go back to some phone calls. We're talking about the commercialization of the Internet. Brian from Liberty. Brian, welcome to Up to Date.
Hey, thank you. This is a great conversation. I plan on being there on Sunday, actually.
Good.
This is just wonderful. My question was, and you were already alluding to it, in the previous conversation, now that the privacy genie is so out of the bottle, now that the internet's not become this open thing that was hoped to be in the early 90s, you were just talking about a solution being to maybe put the internet into more of the form of a post office to make the government and municipalities responsible for providing the service for it. Are there other ways that you see where we could have more respect for individual rights on the internet, outside of the government becoming involved? Are there ways for individuals? Are there opportunities for companies? Are there other opportunities for the government?
Yeah. Good questions, Brian.
What else do you see for solutions for this? And
yeah.
Thanks a lot, guys. And I'll take this off the air. Thanks,
you bet, Brian. Thank you. Bob?
That's a great question. I would say this, though. The government is totally involved with the internet. When you say the government shouldn't be involved with the internet, it's like saying the government shouldn't be involved with Medicare. I mean, it's all over. It created the internet. It started it. It's licensing the key companies. The government policymaking is everywhere. So there's no really – it's what the government's going to do is really the issue, not whether the government's going to do anything. How the government's going to respond to something is really what we're talking about. And, you know, I think that the crucial point we haven't talked about that gets really at these issues, the companies that are doing most of the spying, collecting the data, alongside Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast, and the ISP cartel. But there really gets to the real problem of the internet, as I chronicle in the book and talk about it, which is, you know, when the internet came along, one of its greatest promises probably economically was it was going to blast open capitalism and make it much more competitive. Because thanks to the internet, smaller businesses would be able to inexpensively reach consumers they could never reach before. They'd have access to information. So they'd be able to compete with the big guys.
And some of that is true, right?
Some of it, but not very much. In fact, I would say one of the striking things that you see now as you look at the internet, arguably it's the greatest creator of economic monopoly in the history of capitalism, if not the world. In fact, it's not even arguable. It's beyond argument. It is unquestionably monopoly central. And when you use the term monopoly in economics, you don't mean one company sells every single product in that brand. It's like one company sells all the Coke and cola drinks or something. The way economists use monopoly is that one company is so large that it basically dominates the market. Maybe it has 50, 60, 70, 80% of the market that it can determine how much competition it has by how much profits it wants. If it wants to drive everyone out of business, it might have to take lower profits to do so. So it at least keeps some people in on the margins. And if you look at the internet today, what's happened, it's astonishing, is that there's no middle class of companies like there are in other major industries, mid-sized companies making a lot of money and a lot of competition at that level. Instead, you have a handful of giants that completely dominate the internet: Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, eBay. These companies all rank among the 30, the ones that I just named, basically in the top 10 of the most valuable companies in the economy.
And that happens why, Bob?
It happens primarily for what are called network effects, which is basically on the internet. A company that is number one at providing a service, there are great benefits to everyone out, every customer to use that network because it can offer more. So you go to Google search because its search is better because it has more data to work with. You're going to get a higher quality search. You go to Facebook if you do social media because that's where everyone is. If you go to any other social media, there's no one to social media with. You use Twitter for that reason. You wouldn't use another one because if you go to Twitter, you know, you'll have hundreds of millions, billions of people following you. If you used any other service like that, you'd have 10 people following you, and they'd all quit to join Twitter as soon as they found out. So there's a strong impulse towards monopoly, natural monopoly. It's called network effects online. And what that means is it's left us with this enormous set of huge, powerful monopolistic companies that are soaking up most of the profits online, that dominate it. And these are the companies that have found that the best way to make money, the surest way to make money, is to know everything about people online. They collect all that data because that's where the profits are for Google. That's where the profits are for Facebook. That's where Amazon can hone its services.
They sell the stuff, you're saying.
They sell the stuff, but the crucial data they collect, you know, the line on the internet that I think people should remember, if you get something for free on the internet, you're not the customer, you're the product. You get that for free because they get access to everything you do online. They collect it. They know it. And then they slice and dice you to sell you stuff, to find you, and to commercialize you. That's the deal that's made. You don't voluntarily make it. Most people are, you know, don't have no idea that's happening. But this would be a dubious proposition if we had thousands of companies competing that were all mid-size. But when you've got companies like Google and Facebook and Microsoft, which are among the 10 most valuable companies in the world, or in a couple of the cases at least, Facebook's a little bit down, but it'll soon catch up. Having this amount of power and information and basically really dominating Washington, having no concern about any political repercussions for what they do, unless they're in a battle with each other. But if they're united on something, they own the board. That's not a healthy situation for a free society.
By any standard. We're going to have to leave our conversation there, Bob. Again, Robert McChesney, author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. He speaks at 10 Sunday morning at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City. Bob, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for the provocative conversation, and a lot of folks will look forward to seeing you on Sunday morning.
Well, thank you, Steve. Good luck with your show.
You bet. Appreciate it very much.